Kennedy was great. Kennedy was young. Kennedy was exciting. I was a liberal, you know, and my parents let me stay up late on election night, and it took hours to find out if he won, and the next morning I was really happy. And then a lot of the rest of my life has been dealing with the disillusionment that followed that night. Kennedy got us into Vietnam. Kennedy didn't support civil rights, even though he said he did. Kennedy was more interested in killing Castro than in bringing justice to the third world. If you feel like you're hearing a little too much about this on Beneath the Surface, now you know why.
John Wiener hosts Beneath the Surface Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 5 on 90.7 KPFK.
But what together we can do for the freedom of man.
Hi, this is Earl O'Fari Hutchinson. Join me tomorrow for Tuesday Live. It's Tuesday Live from 7 to 8 p.m. That's Provocative Talk Radio on KPFK Los Angeles. Tomorrow, Tuesday Live, 7 to 8 p.m. Listen in.
Good evening. This is Stephen Starr, and you're listening to KPFK FM 90.7 in Los Angeles. Today, in our continuing series of Monday in March, we have an opportunity to explore further some of the issues that have beset Pacifica in recent months and years. As you all know, there's been a bit of a struggle. One of the earliest actions I was able to take in coming back to the station here was putting Democracy Now! Back on the air in both of the time slots that it had been previously unable to fill. It started at 6. We moved it on to 9 a.m. It's now heard both at 6 and 9 every day here on KPFK. And I think in the interest of giving you listeners a better window on just what happened with Democracy Now! And what happened when they decided to move out of the WBAI facilities in New York, there was a moment in history that was well expressed by Juan Gonzalez, one of the Democracy Now! Producers. And this moment is captured in a speech that took place in the fall, in October, in Los Angeles, where Juan traced the history of the struggle that we were all faced with over the last period at Pacifica. And that speech is about to be played here on KPFK FM in Los Angeles. So let's tune in and listen to Juan Gonzalez tell us about recent struggles in Pacific history this Monday in March.
Thank you and good afternoon to all of you, and thanks to Jan and Jerry and all of the people who worked to put this event together, and to John Connolly, for the president of AFTRA, for coming and reiterating and making clear the support of AFTRA for Amy and for her producers Brad and Chris, and for Anthony the technical director at Democracy Now!, who has because it was four people who all agreed that the working conditions at WBAI were actually becoming dangerous to their physical health, and decided to continue broadcasting, but from somewhere else, until Pacifica could figure out how to deal with his own management people and the way that they are treating not just Amy and the rest of the Democracy Now! Staff, but anyone who dares to raise questions about the way that they're conducting business at that community radio station that is so important to the people of New York City. I believe, and I began, because I was working on Democracy Now! With Amy for 5 years, and every once in a while I would hear, there's this battle going on in the Pacifica board, and Amy would tell me, Mary Frances Berry's trying to do this and do that, and I would tell her, look, Amy, I've been in contact with Pacifica since 1969, since I was a member of the Young Lords, and WBAI gave us a show, our organization, a show to reach out to the Puerto Rican community. There's always been battles in Pacifica, and it's just part of the reality. Amy would tell me, no, but this one is different. There's something else going on here, and I kept not paying attention. Many people at WBAI didn't pay attention. Many people at KPFK didn't pay attention, because part of what's happened with these stations is that they all developed relatively autonomously, and the people who were producers or on these shows only cared about their show, their station, and weren't really paying attention to what was going on in the overall network. And I think this is part of what allowed this group of people not just by Mary Frances Berry, because we would be mistaken to think that this is a group of individuals. If we do that, we would miss the overall direction and thrust of what has been going on. And I'd like to talk for a minute about what that thrust is. And a lot of this I've gotten in long conversations with Dave Adelson and others who've been battling this fight far longer than those of us who were involved in other things. But somewhere around the early 1990s, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which, as many of you know, is the quasi-governmental public-private entity that helps to fund many community radio stations, put together a task force to study the future of community radio. And they were recognizing the changing environment in American society, the growing rise of the right and conservative forces, and the new market realities of the United States given the changes in the world situation. And they asked this task force to come up with plans for how was community radio going to survive in the new environment. So that task force came up with the Healthy Stations strategy or model, wherein they urged that community radio should cease to try to be all things to all people. Community radio stations should no longer try to service their entire community, because it was not going to be viable for them to survive economically in the changing economic realities of the United States. Instead, community radio stations should identify a niche audience. A niche audience that could, while it may not be large, had sufficient money that it could allow the stations to survive. So that the idea was, it's not necessary to have 25 people each listening 1 hour or 2 hours during the week to their particular favorite program. It's better to have five people that listen 25 hours during the week, have more of an investment in the station, and are willing to give money to it. So you just have to find your niche audience and then direct your programming to that niche audience, and stop this idea of thinking you can serve the entire community. And in addition, you have to professionalize the product. Don't get involved with so many of these volunteer listeners. You know, have more professional people, and best better have better, more market-oriented approach to nonprofit community radio. Two of the people who served on that task force of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting were named Pat Scott and Lynn Chadwick. Pat Scott subsequently left that task force and became the executive director of Pacifica. And she was the one who really started the first purges, as I understand it, here at KPFK, where they got rid of all of these producers and began to create a smaller professional staff that dominated the airwaves more, and began to orient the niche audience in Los Angeles to being largely the largely middle class, liberal, radical community of the west side of Los Angeles. And the Latino community was pretty much left out. The African American community was pretty much left out. That was the niche audience that KPFK developed. In Houston, they chose a different route. In Houston, they turned the station into a country music station called The Sound of Texas, geared largely to the white community of Houston, even though Houston is one-third African-American and one-third Latino. KPFT in Houston chose that niche audience. In Washington, D.C., they turned the station into largely a jazz station. And in Washington, D.C., the niche audience was the middle and upper class black community of the suburbs. The listenership of WPFW in D.C. is not the inner city black community. It is the government employees and the middle class black population in Maryland and Virginia in the suburbs. So in each station, depending on what their market was, the niche audience that was refashioned as to where the Pacifica station would go was in that direction. Two of the five stations held out. KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York insisted that they were going to maintain the old mission of Pacifica to try to reach all of the communities in their area, and not as much with music, because there was lots of music, although they do play music, but there's lots of music on all the other commercial stations, but to maintain overwhelmingly talk, news, and political programming. And that was the battle as it developed, and Pat Scott started it, and then Lynn Chadwick, who had been on the same task force when it got too hot for Pat Scott, then followed. And in essence, it is not the individuals that are involved. It is a, it is an ideology. It is a way of broadcasting now that is basically being supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is now being now headed, of course, by a former Voice of America propagandist, as is NPR. This is the orientation that they sought to achieve. The governance issue arose because there was resistance. When Pat Scott tried to implement this stuff, there was resistance because in these local communities, people were, listeners were really invested in these stations and in the community advisory boards, and they resisted. So Pacifica, those on the board who supported this idea said, well, before we can fully implement this, we're going to have to change this governance structure because there's too much local autonomy. We got to centralize management. We've got a centralized power in the national board, and we have to change the governance structure. So they set about, as a means of overcoming the resistance, to change the governance structure and seize control. And that, so they did that, as Dave mentioned, in 99, when they created a self-perpetuating board and therefore eliminated local nominations from the local advisory boards, or appointments from the local advisory board to the national board. And subsequent to that, there have been battles or differences on the board in terms of this whole issue of sale. We've raised this. Some of the people who were on the board apparently believed that a sale of one of the stations would be beneficial in terms of being able, and let's put the best argument on their side, not the worst. The best argument on their side is, hey, if we were to sell KPFA or sell WBAI, get all that money that's there, buy another frequency further down on the dial for less money, and turn that money into an endowment for Pacifica. That's the best argument that they had on the possibility of sales. But there were others on the board who were actually seeking to make money from the sales. And if you read the proposed bylaw revisions that John Murdoch put forward some time ago, you'll see the long sections on a conflict of interest that were basically to protect any board member from being, that would be involved possibly in any conflict because a family member or a company that they were involved in might be involved in any transactions or services for transfers of assets of Pacifica. So the board really was composed and is composed of a variety of people. They're not all united in the same direction. Some see the need for a political change in the nature of the programming that Pacifica has, that they come from that stream of people that believe in the CPB's Healthy Stations Task Force approach. Some are just greedy and see a chance to make a lot of money. and like Bert Lee, who's done this before on with media properties. And some just, you know, there's been a lot made of this whole race issue that Eutrice Leigh in New York, that Bessie Wash, that even Mary Frances Berry has raised at several points, that what's going on here is that a bunch of old radical white men have controlled the Pacifica network, and now that African Americans are in positions of power, they don't want to take the leadership of African Americans who want to take Pacifica in a different direction. A lot of people are not aware of the fact that Pacifica several years ago recreated itself as a minority-owned radio network. That's why it requires at least that a majority of the membership of the board be of African Americans and Latinos. They did that in part to access a separate funding stream from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that was geared to minority-owned radio operations. And in the process, though, that's how many of the current board members under Mary Frances Berry's direction at the time got on the board. Now, again, to take the best arguments on their side, I believe that what Mary Frances Berry envisioned was, in essence, a black-owned alternative to NPR. She saw this small network, very valuable, but basically dysfunctional because of battles that had gone on. She saw a vacuum. She was named to the board with the support of Jack O'Dell and some of the other longtime members of the board, and then became chairperson, and then said, hey, we are going to take over this network, and we're going to be able to do things that previously were not able to be done, because we're going to have a public or community radio network that is controlled and managed by African Americans.
You're listening to Juan Gonzalez in a speech he gave in the fall in Los Angeles with John Connolly and the AFTER organization to describe and discuss what happened at Pacifica and where we are today.
And in the process, though, they had to appeal when there was resistance, turn the battle into a battle that was thwarting self-determination, that was thwarting a possibility to move forward in the black community. The problem is that when you look at the people who are on that board, they don't have any history of being involved in battles for self-determination. Even Mary Frances Berry's credentials as a civil rights leader, in my mind, I mean, when I think of civil rights leaders who have fought in this country to advance the cause of civil rights, Mary Frances Berry is not she's not in the top 10, she's not in the top 50 who have sacrificed and fought in this country to build the civil rights movement. She was largely an academic and government bureaucrat who was in the right places at the right time. So that we have people like John Murdoch, from the law firm Bepstein, Becker, and Green, a real force for civil rights in America. We have Wendell Johns, who works for Fannie Mae, and his wife is a major executive in the Verizon telephone company, another force for civil rights in America. And we have Ken Ford, who works for the National Association of Home Builders, a real force for equality and social change in America, and the folks who have left since our campaign started, none of them have any kind of distinguished track record. We had Michael Palmer, who was a major a salesman, vice president for C.B. Richard Ellis and Company, the largest commercial real estate company in the world. And you go to their website and they'll tell you about all the factories that they've leased for major corporations in Mexico maquilas that they've put together, maquila projects. And I say to myself, how did these people ever get on the Pacifica board? How did it happen that people with no history, I mean, at least Mary Frances Berry could claim a certain relationship to the movements for social change in American society, but these other folks had no relationship or history in the battles for civil rights and social change in American society, and now they were in charge. They were suddenly in charge because the rest of us were not paying attention. So the reality in terms of this battle, these allegations that this is a racist movement, is really a smokescreen. Now, I am not going to tell you, and I'll be the first to say, that there are many people who are part of our reform movement who've got some prejudices, who are racist in some of their attitudes. There definitely are. And we would be refusing to see reality if we didn't say that we got some people within our own movement that have some problems. Some of them call up some of these folks and say some really ridiculous stuff. But if any network, any radio operation in the United States of America has fought for understanding and for in support of civil rights and in support of social change, and it has been Pacifica. And while we live in a society where no one escapes the impact of racism, it's also true that Pacifica has always been a home for understanding and for greater unity between the races and the nationalities, and not for divisions. So that I think that that the allegations are a smokescreen. Those of us who've been involved in social movements for a long time have seen it before. We don't fall for it. We're not intimidated by it. We are going to continue to maintain that Pacifica is a network where people are brought together, not torn apart and not divided over race and over nationality and ethnic differences. So that Eutrice Leet has gone on the air saying that this is a race war and calling on stalwart soldiers to come to her support. Now, this is not a war. Some of us know what real war is. This is a social conflict. It is a social conflict. It is not anywhere near being a war. These allegations of violence that have been thrown around, the people who are claiming violence don't know what violence is. They have no idea what violence is. The reality is that the movement to reform Pacifica is a peaceful movement. It is a movement that we're trying to exhort people to approach this with the highest standards and dignity. But yes, with the relentless pressure, direct action, picketing, whatever pressure we can bring to bear on these folks to let them know that this is not their network. This network belongs to the listeners, and it belongs to the employees, and it does not belong to a board that has nothing in common with the history of Pacifica and the vision of Pacifica and with the unique role that Pacifica has played in American society. Now, I know a lot of people are torn about this whole issue. Well, if we don't give money and we don't support it, then the stations will die, and we're tearing the network apart. Now, believe me, I grapple with this and I try to understand what other way we can approach it. The problem is that they always expected, and to this day I think Shub and Eutrice Leet in New York and Mary Berry feel the same way, that the listeners, because they are invested in the institution, because they so treasure the institution, they will never stop abandoning the institution, even when those who are in power are taking the institution in a direction that is totally antithetical to its mission and purpose. So they rely, you know, it's like people say, well, the Democratic Party, the people that it pays least attention to are African Americans and Latinos, because they know there's no place else where they can go. Well, this is the attitude that Pacifica has taken toward the listeners. Where else are they going to go? This is the institution that has continued to passionately supported and battled for the issues that the listeners are concerned about. But it's sort of like when, you know, you've been... It's somebody mentioned to me that Pacifica was always an icon in their lives, and when you realize that an institution that you treasure, that you've always seen as a part of your life, is suddenly becoming a stranger and is suddenly controlled by people who you don't really understand what they're doing, it tears at you. How do you get these people out without destroying the institution? So that's why we said, first of all, the only way you can get every single listener to make a decision to let Pacifica know how they feel is through a call for a boycott. Because in at least through a boycott, every single listener has a vote. Every single listener has a vote. If we are wrong, if we in the Pacifica campaign and other folks are wrong, then the vast majority of the listeners will continue to give money and Pacifica will go right on its way, and it should. If we are wrong and we are, and what we're saying does not accord with the beliefs of the listeners that Pacifica is being hijacked in a different direction, then we should be defeated. But if we are right and the listeners agree that they don't like what's happening and they don't like the fact that they haven't been had a say, then they will let us know. It's a simple national referendum. The boycott is a national referendum. Now, we don't want to destroy the network in the process. That's why we're trying to end this thing as quickly as possible. And we've had amazing success with pressure on the board members. When I resigned on January 31st, there were 17 people on the Pacifica board. There were 11 bad guys and gals, and there were 6 good guys and gals. It was 11 to 6. The vote. Now, about 7 months later, the bad side has lost 5. And the good side lost 1. So the vote went from 11 to 7 to now 6 to 5. There's only one board member separates those who are the dissidents between those who want to maintain and keep course with the way they're going now. However, as we would expect, Pacifica is not exactly like waiting for us to achieve victory. So now they've upped the ante, because what really happened when Bessie Wash fired Epstein Becker and brought in Williams and Connolly and the Jaworski firm, and when she brought in West Hill Partners, is that Bessie Wash engineered a coup within a coup. You know, those of you who I've done a lot of coverage of political dictatorships in other countries, and sometimes the first group of generals that seize power are not right-wing enough, so a more militant group of right-wingers overthrows them. So what happened was Bessie Wash got together with Mark Schaub and Eutrice Leed and Ganser, the station manager in Houston. And because remember, Pacifica has only one officer left. The chairman, Acosta, we forced him to resign. The secretary, Andrea Sisco, we forced her to resign. The treasurer, Michael Palmer, we forced him to resign. There's only one officer left in the Pacifica board. That's Ford, who's the vice chairman. The board has not met since early March. And when it met in March, it couldn't conduct its meeting because there were hundreds of people protesting and they had to adjourn the meeting. So that, in essence, there is no one in charge at Pacifica right now. There are no officers. They haven't met. So in the absence of a directing body, the full-time staff led by Bessie Wash have seized power. And the first thing they did was to fire the law firm Epstein Becker that was suggesting we should negotiate a settlement. And then they brought in West Hill Partners. Now, I don't know how many of you know West Hill Partners. I know West Hill Partners well. West Hill Partners is one of the top damage control public relations firms in America. Their head used to be John Scanlon. He just died a few months ago. I first ran into Scanlon when we were on strike with the Daily News against the Tribune Company, one of the most powerful media companies in America. And the Tribune Company was getting blasted in the press because everybody from the Cardinal to Governor Cuomo to Mayor Dinkins, everyone was supporting us. So they hired John Scanlon and his people.